I want you to picture something for a second. You know, you were just driving home.
Right, just a normal commute.
Exactly. It is a route you have taken, I mean, probably 1,000 times before. Maybe you were cruising down the Hutchinson River Parkway.
Oh, yeah, or navigating those really familiar winding curves on I-287.
Yeah. It is a completely mundane, almost boring scenario, right?
Right.
The radio is playing something you are only, like, half listening to.
You are probably just thinking about what to pull out of the freezer for dinner.
Or mentally running through tomorrow's exhausting to-do list.
Yeah.
But then in a fraction of a second, that entirely normal Tuesday evening is just violently interrupted.
Yeah.
And not because your brakes failed, not because a tree fell on the road, but because of another driver's terrible, entirely preventable decision.
It really is the ultimate loss of control. I mean, you are doing everything right. You are following all the invisible rules of the road that we all implicitly agree to. And someone else's choice just completely shatters your reality. It is a terrifying concept because it highlights how fragile that shared trust actually is.
It really does. And that brings us to the mission for today's deep dive. We have been poring over a huge stack of legal documents, accident data, and case studies focused on the grim realities of drunk driving accidents, specifically right here in Westchester County in New York City.
Yeah, we're keeping it local today.
Exactly. We are going to look at the actual physics and mechanics of these crashes, you know, how they happen on our local roads and the incredibly complex legal aftermath that follows.
Which is a maze, honestly.
Totally. And we'll also look at the critical ecosystem of personal injury law. We're going to be looking closely at the law offices of Norman Gershon as a sort of case study in how aggressive legal representation actually functions in the real world when, you know, when the chips are down.
Which I think is a necessary shift in perspective, because usually when society talks about drunk driving, the focus is, well, it's almost entirely on the criminal punishment of the driver.
Yeah, the perpetrator.
Right. We talk about the flashing lights, the breathalyzer, the handcuffs, the court date. The perpetrator gets all the attention. But this analysis is going to shift the spotlight to where it is often most needed, yet frequently overlooked, which is the victims.
Absolutely.
The innocent people left standing on the side of the road whose lives have just been completely upended.
Okay, let's unpack this, because the way these accidents actually play out on the road is chilling. When you look at the crash data, these collisions rarely start like something out of a Hollywood action movie.
No, not at all.
There's no dramatic buildup. There is no, like, cinematic music swelling in the background to warn you.
No, the physical reality is much more insidious than that. The data details how it often begins with incredibly subtle, almost imperceptible failures.
Like what?
Well, just a slight drifting across the double yellow line. Or a delayed reaction to a brake light three cars ahead.
Wow.
Yeah, or a complete failure to register that a traffic light has cycled from yellow to red. It's quiet until it isn't.
Right, and the specific impairment mechanics we read about paint a terrifying picture of a driver who is essentially disconnected from the environment around them.
Yeah, they're in their own world.
Impaired drivers aren't just driving badly. They're operating in a delayed reality. They run stop signs, they drift into oncoming traffic, or literally, this happens too often, drive the wrong way down a highway on-ramp.
It's terrifying. Let's look at the why behind that. When a driver is impaired, alcohol or drugs suppress the central nervous system.
Okay.
So that combination impaired spatial judgment mixed with delayed physical reflexes is lethal. When a driver misjudges speed and distance, they aren't just making a small, you know, geometric error. They are fundamentally violating the physics that keep everyone safe on the road.
Because they can't react in time.
Exactly. By the time their brain processes the hazard, their foot is seconds too late hitting the brake pedal. Or worse, they just don't brake at all.
And we are seeing the results of this everywhere locally. We're talking about White Plains, Yonkers, the Bronx, Queens, Manhattan.
The whole area.
Narrow, unforgiving arteries like the Bronx River Parkway. These specific sensory impairments lead directly to horrific intersection crashes, head-on collisions, and massive multi-vehicle pileups.
It's a mess.
It makes me think of an analogy. It's like dropping a wrench into the finely tuned gears of a clock. Traffic, especially in New York, relies on this invisible social contract.
Right.
Everyone follows the same physical rules. They stop at the same red lights. They stay in their designated lanes. When one person completely unplugs from that shared reality, the whole system just collapses.
The clock analogy works perfectly because the entire traffic system is built on predictable behavior. You assume the person coming the other way is going to stay in their lane.
You have to assume that.
Right. intoxication introduces utter unpredictability into a system that simply cannot handle it.
But here is the thing that really gets me, and it is such a grim irony. Law enforcement officers need reasonable suspicion to pull someone over. They get the luxury of observing the drifting, watching the erratic braking from a safe distance, and deciding to intervene with their sirens blaring. But the innocent victims...
They don't get that warning.
No. Mm. The family heading home from a school play.
Yeah.
They never get that warning.
Right.
They just get the impact.
And suddenly, without any warning at all, that family is thrust into an incredibly complex legal machine. There is a deeply ingrained societal assumption about justice when it comes to drunk driving, and it centers entirely on New York Vehicle and Traffic Law, Section 1192.
Okay, that's the criminal side of things, right? Like the actual laws on the books.
Precisely. Section 1192 outlines the multiple levels of intoxicated driving in New York, ranging from DWAI, which is driving while ability impaired,
right,
all the way up to aggravated DWI for incredibly high blood alcohol content. The legal framework here involves severe criminal penalties. We are talking mandatory license revocation, massive fines, and significant jail time.
But wait, let me stop you right there, because this is where I think people get really confused. If a drunk driver hits me, blows a 0.15 on the breathalyzer, gets arrested, gets their license revoked, and goes to jail, doesn't their insurance company just look at the police report, admit fault, and write a check for my hospital bills?
You would think so, right?
I mean, why is there even a fight if the other guy is clearly guilty and literally behind bars?
What's fascinating here is that the criminal case is literally only half the story.
Really?
Yeah. And for the injured victim, it might actually be the less impactful half when it comes to rebuilding their life. Because no, auto insurance companies do not just write a blank check because their client was arrested.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Even with a clear-cut police report?
Absolutely. The state prosecutes the criminal case to protect the public and punish the offender. The district attorney's job is to put the drunk driver in jail, not to negotiate your physical therapy bills.
Oh, wow.
Right. The criminal justice system punishes the driver, but it doesn't heal the victim. To get healed financially, victims have a completely separate, distinct right to pursue financial compensation through a civil case.
So you are basically fighting a two-front war.
Exactly. The criminal court puts them in a cell, but the civil court is what actually forces the driver's insurance company to pay for your surgeries, your lost wages, and your ongoing care.
And insurance companies aren't exactly eager to hand over that money.
Not at all. They are deeply adversarial. Their entire business model is based on minimizing payouts. This separate legal track is precisely why having an experienced car accident lawyer becomes absolutely critical. You cannot rely on the prosecutor to secure your financial future.
So if the state is essentially washing its hands of your medical debt, you are certainly thrust into this chaotic civil system while you are probably still sitting in a hospital bed.
Yeah.
How on earth are you supposed to navigate that? Fortunately, the materials we are reviewing actually provide a post-crash playbook. It is essentially a what-to-do-in-the-worst-case scenario guide for anyone driving in Westchester County or NYC.
And I cannot stress enough how important it is to internalize these steps now. Because when you are on the side of the highway, you know, amidst broken glass and blaring sirens, your cognitive functioning is not going to be at its peak.
No, you're in shock. So step one is obvious but crucial. Call 911 immediately. You need police on the scene to document the intoxication, secure the area, and create that official record.
Right.
But step two is where people often make a massive, like, case-destroying mistake. You need to seek medical attention immediately, even if your injuries seem minor.
I want to spend a moment on that word minor, because it is incredibly deceptive in the context of an automobile accident.
How so?
Well, when you are involved in a traumatic event like a crash, your body triggers a massive physiological response. It floods your system with adrenaline and endorphins. This is an evolutionary survival mechanism designed to basically mask pain so you can escape danger.
So you might step out of your smashed vehicle on the Hutchinson River Parkway feeling totally fine. Maybe you think, I just want to go home and sleep this off in my own bed.
And that is the worst thing you can do.
Really?
You might feel fine, maybe just a little stiff, but underlying tissue damage, microscopic tears in your muscles from whiplash, or even slow internal bleeding, those might not manifest symptoms until hours or even days later.
I don't know if that makes sense.
And from a legal standpoint, if you refuse medical attention at the scene, You are creating a documented gap in your medical records. The insurance adjusters will absolutely weaponize that gap.
No, I bet they
They
will.
will point to it and say, well, if you were really hurt, you would have taken the ambulance. You must have injured your back playing tennis 2 days later.
Wow. The psychology of that is so frustrating, but it makes total sense from their greedy perspective. Okay, so get checked out immediately no matter what. Let the paramedics do their job.
Exactly.
The next steps on the checklist: document the scene with photos, snap pictures of the vehicles, the license plates, the road conditions, just everything you can safely capture. Then get witness information.
Yes.
Do not assume the police will track down every bystander who saw the crash.
Never assume that. And then we reach what is arguably the most critical warning in the entire playbook. Avoid speaking with any insurance companies before getting legal guidance.
Yeah, that adjuster who calls you at 9 a.m. the morning after the crash, the one who sounds super friendly and just wants to check in on how you're feeling,
yeah,
they are not your friend.
Precisely. They know you are disoriented, probably running on zero sleep and possibly on pain medication. They want to get a recorded statement from you right then and there.
They're fishing for something.
They are hoping you will say something completely innocent, like, oh, I'm feeling okay today, just a little sore, which they will then lock in as evidence to deny a massive long-term spinal injury claim that presents itself 3 weeks later. They're gathering ammunition to minimize their financial exposure.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because the transition from what the victim does at the chaotic scene of the crash to what a high-powered lawyer does in a sterile courtroom completely changes the balance of power.
It does.
When you dive into the data on how victims actually win these complex civil fights, one local firm's name keeps coming up as a sort of case study in how this ecosystem works: the law offices of Norman Gershon. And they are framed in a very particular way in the sources.
Right.
They're described as the lawyers that other attorneys call to try their toughest cases.
If we connect this to the bigger picture of how the legal industry operates, that distinction is massive. Listeners might not realize this, but the world of personal injury law is vast and highly segmented.
Like different specialties.
Basically, many lawyers out there essentially run settlement mills. They handle paperwork, they negotiate basic settlements, and they frankly never set foot inside a courtroom. They don't want to go to trial. It's expensive and it's time consuming.
But what happens when an insurance company simply refuses to play fair? What if they look at a catastrophic injury and offer pennies on the dollar?
That is exactly when those settlement lawyers have to call in a trial specialist, someone who actually knows how to litigate in front of a jury. The dynamic with insurance companies completely shifts when a lawyer with over 35 years of actual trial experience enters the picture.
Oh, I'm sure.
The data explicitly shows that insurance companies know, and frankly fear, experienced trial attorneys like Norman Gershon.
Why, though?
Yeah.
Just because he's intimidating in a suit.
Because of the underlying math.
Yeah.
Yeah. Insurance companies use complex algorithms to calculate risk. Going to trial costs the insurance company massive amounts of money in their own legal fees. More importantly, it risks putting the decision in the hands of a wildcard jury.
Yeah, right. Juries are people.
Exactly. Juries often sympathize with victims of drunk driving and can award enormous punitive damages. An experienced trial lawyer is fully prepared to take the case to a verdict, meaning they neutralize the insurance company's primary weapon, which is the threat of dragging things out.
You can't bluff someone who actually wants to go to trial.
Right. They can't bluff a lawyer who is already picking out a suit for opening statements.
But that raises a really practical, almost mathematical question for the average person. Let's say I'm the victim. I'm reeling from a horrific crash on I-287. My ambulance bills are piling up. I've missed 3 weeks of work. I can barely afford groceries right now.
It's a terrifying position to be in.
How on earth does someone in that compromised financial position afford to hire a high-powered trial lawyer that other lawyers are intimidated by? I mean, that sounds like a rich person's privilege.
It is a vital question, and it speaks to how the civil justice system tries to democratize access to top-tier legal talent. The answer is the contingency fee model. The explicit guarantee here is that victims only pay if you win.
So the financial risk is entirely shifted off my shoulders.
Correct. The lawyer absorbs all the upfront risk. They finance the private investigators. They pay the accident reconstruction experts. They cover the exorbitant court filing fees. And they spend hundreds of hours preparing for trial.
And if they lose?
If they do not secure a financial recovery for the victim owes them absolutely nothing for their time or those expenses. It is the only mechanism that allows a regular citizen to level the playing field against a multi-billion dollar insurance corporation.
It essentially forces the lawyer to put their money where their mouth is. They won't take your case unless they actually believe they can win it.
Precisely.
And for anyone listening in the NYC or Westchester area who might suddenly find themselves in this nightmare scenario, there's a direct lifeline to this level of representation. The number is 914-485-1444. Again, that's 914-485-1444.
Having a direct line to an advocate who deeply understands the local courts, the local insurance adjusters, and the intricacies of navigating both the civil system and the fallout of the criminal system is essential.
And when we look at the scorecard, the actual verdicts and settlements achieved by the firm we are using as our case study, it is staggering. We are not talking about small claims court here.
Yeah, we are definitely not.
We are talking about tens of millions of dollars recovered overall. Let's look at a few specific wins from the text to understand the scale. There is a $16.5 million verdict for an auto passenger involved in a crash with a bus in the Bronx.
Wow.
A $14.5 million settlement for an MTA bus accident in Queens. A $7.5 million verdict for a bus passenger injury. Multiple verdicts over $5 million in various severe car accident cases. And a $2.5 million verdict specifically for an intersection crash right here in Westchester County.
This raises an important question. What do these massive numbers actually represent?
Right.
Because it is very easy to hear a phrase like $16.5 million and just think of it as a financial statistic or like winning the lottery. But when we connect those numbers back to the physical realities of the crashes we discussed earlier, the high-speed head-on collisions, the catastrophic multi-vehicle pileups, we realize those verdicts aren't windfalls.
They're survival funds.
They represent catastrophic, life-altering injuries.
Right. They represent the astronomical cost of healthcare in America. That $16.5 million isn't vacation money. It is a lifetime of specialized medical care. It is retrofitting a home for wheelchair accessibility.
Yeah.
It is compensating a 30-year-old for 25 years of lost earning capacity because they can never, ever work in their field again.
Exactly. They represent an advocate forcing a resistant insurance company to fully account for the total destruction of a person's previous life. And we can actually see the psychological impact of this in the client testimonials.
Yeah, and instead of just reading them like a review site, when you synthesize what these clients are actually saying in the sources, a clear pattern emerges.
What did you notice?
Well, you have people like Nancy Joyce, Lance, and ZB from New York. And while they use different words praising him for working his magic, being thorough, confident, and top-notch in the courtroom, or noting that he fights for your rights and leaves nothing to chance, the underlying sentiment is profound relief.
It is the relief of handing an unbearable burden to someone capable of carrying it.
So, what does this all mean? When you look at the entire picture, the mechanics of the crashes, the adversarial nature of insurance companies, the massive verdicts, and the personal relief of the clients, they are consistently describing an attorney who is incredibly prepared, highly aggressive on their behalf, and deeply committed to the outcome.
And I would argue that those three traits, preparation, aggression, and commitment, are the exact formula required to force the civil justice system to work.
Yeah, you need all three.
Insurance companies do not pay out millions of dollars out of the goodness of their hearts. They pay it because the alternative, facing a fiercely prepared, top-notch trial lawyer in front of a jury, is statistically too risky for their bottom line.
Which brings us to the ultimate takeaway of today's deep dive. The most heartbreaking thread woven through everything we've discussed today is that drunk driving crashes are 100% preventable.
Every single one of them.
Every single one of them is a choice. But when someone makes that terrible choice to get behind the wheel impaired, the consequences for the innocent people sharing the road are absolute devastation. If you or someone you love is hit in Westchester County, in White Plains, or anywhere across the five boroughs in New York City, the criminal justice system is not going to put your life back together.
No, it's not designed to.
You need a trial-tested advocate who knows how to navigate the civil war that follows.
We've spent a lot of time today talking about how the civil justice system is the only mechanism for a victim to be made financially whole. But looking at all of this, it forces us to ask a rather difficult, maybe philosophical question about the way our society is structured.
What's that?
Why is the immense soul-crushing burden of financial recovery placed entirely on the shoulders of the traumatized victim?
That is a great point.
I mean, they did absolutely nothing wrong. They were just driving home, thinking about dinner. Yet they're the ones who have to fight tooth and nail against massive corporate insurance companies just to pay for their own surgeries.
It's completely backward.
It really is. And until that underlying system changes, your physical and financial recovery isn't guaranteed by the state, and it certainly isn't guaranteed by the drunk driver who hit you. It is determined entirely by the strength of the advocate you choose to stand beside you in the aftermath.
And when you are suddenly pulled out of your mundane, peaceful drive on the Hutchinson River Parkway and violently forced into that broken reality, having an advocate who refuses to let the gears of that clock stay broken might just be the only way forward.